The Guardian.
Jess Phillips bows out of the Labour leadership race and the House of Lords tries to change Boris Johnson's Brexit deal. I'm Rowena Mason, Deputy Political Editor of The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly.
And I have to be honest with myself, as I said I always would be throughout this campaign, that at this time, that person isn't me.
The Birmingham Yardley MP Jess Phillips announced that she was dropping out of the Labour leadership campaign. In a video address posted on Twitter yesterday, Phillips admitted that when it comes to finding a person that can unite all factions of the Labour Party, at this time, that person isn't her. So who will it be? With still 2 months to go, there are only four MPs left in the contest, leading some to question whether there'll be a broad slate in the competition. So should there be a review of the rules dictating Labour leadership elections again? And in other news, just when you thought the Prime Minister's Brexit deal was as good as done, the House of Lords attempted to make some changes. Four amendments to the bill were passed by peers, which would, among other things, ensure protection for unaccompanied child refugees seeking asylum and provide physical documentation to EU nationals living in the UK. It's expected that the Tory majority in the House of Commons will just overrule these amendments later today, showing the days of the Lords flexing their muscles against the Commons belong in the last Parliament. Stormont also voted down Johnson's Brexit withdrawal bill, and as Michel Barnier plans his trip to Northern Ireland next week, we ask, how much might it be a thorn in the Prime Minister's side? And if that wasn't enough, later on my colleague Kate Proctor sits down with the activist Gina Miller to get some of her thoughts ahead of the 31st of January Brexit deadline. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, as we record, a cohort of world leaders, academics and business people are mingling in a small, wealthy town in the Swiss Alps. This year marks the 50th World Economic Forum in Davos, where the global elite congregate to figure out ways that they think will improve the state of the world. Hello there, Larry.
Hello.
I rang The Guardian's economics editor, Larry Elliott, earlier on to get the latest news. So you're there in Davos with all the global movers and shakers. What's the atmosphere like?
Oh, it's totally manic. Trump's been in town and he brings an enormous army of hangers-on, press, security guards. The place goes into complete lockdown. The entire place goes completely wild.
Have you been held up by his motorcade yet?
No, I haven't. I've been actually inside the conference centre. I think outside it has been, you know, the place has been in gridlock. I mean, one of the sort of interesting things is that, you know, Davos is supposed to be becoming more sustainable and there's a big push on climate change this year. And yet you go out in the streets at night and it's sort of, you know, traffic from one end of the town to the other. It's absolute sort of traffic gridlock with people who, you know, might be better off getting off their fat bums and walking a bit rather than sitting in a massive limo to go from hotel to hotel.
And talking of climate change, everyone is waiting to see what happens when Greta Thunberg and Donald Trump are in each other's presence. How has that story played out so far?
Oh, it's been an absolute cracker. I mean, they haven't actually met, but you know, yesterday or on Monday it was a complete climate change fest here, you know, because Greta was doing her bit with some of the other young activists saying that the planet is on fire and that, you know, Trump's plan to plant a trillion trees by 2030. And for Greta, this wasn't really facing up to the scale of the problem. So she said, our planet's on fire, still on fire. And, you know, Trump in his keynote address, which was, I say, not especially well received in Davos, talked about prophets of doom and the people who'd predicted the apocalypse in the you know, overpopulation in the 60s and end of oil in the 1990s. I mean, he wasn't taking anything from Greta. He was going to give as good as he got. So it became quite a good story, you know, the sort of climate-denying tycoon president against the, you know, 17-year-old Swedish schoolgirl. It was actually, you know, it had all the ingredients for a great story. I mean, the only thing it lacked was, you know, the moment when the two met, but that didn't happen, which was a great, great shame, obviously. But I mean, that's part of the sort of lockdown of Davos. Trump is just meeting the people he wants to meet and doesn't meet people he doesn't want to meet.
That's clearly been the biggest story so far. But as far as the UK is concerned, Boris Johnson's made clear that he wanted his ministers to be working at home rather than swanning around at Davos. But the Chancellor Sajid Javid was there. Is that right? Has he been making much of an impact?
He is there. And he has been at the eye of a bit of a storm over Britain's plans for a tax on big tech companies, which is coming into force in April. And the Americans have really cut up quite rough about it. I mean, Steve Mnuchin, the US Treasury Secretary, has been making some fairly sort of menacing noises about the implications for the UK if it goes ahead with this plan. Sajid Javid has said that it's coming in April and that it will stay in force until an international deal, which is being sorted out by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, so the Paris-based West think tank. But once that's sorted out, the UK will drop its unilateral approach. But the Americans are not very happy about it. And it comes at a particularly sensitive time because the UK is desperately trying to forge a quick and quite deep trade deal with the US after Brexit. And so you want the mood music to be as peaceful and as calm as possible. It was quite an interesting row. I mean, I think more generally, the reason that Sajid Javid is here and Boris Johnson isn't is that, to an extent, some world leaders have realised that being in Davos, rubbing shoulders with the global elite, is not the world's best look when you've got massive populist protests going on at home. So, there's no President Macron of France, there's no Trudeau of Canada. They've all stayed away. So, which sort of suggests that Davos needs a bit of an image makeover, really, I think. Some of the leading politicians have started to wonder whether the publicity they get out of coming to Davos is worth it.
Thanks, Larry. I hope you're not too cold out there.
Oh, thanks, Rowena. Pleasure. Okay, bye.
That was Larry Elliott, The Guardian's economics editor. Back in the studio, I'm joined by The Guardian's Brexit correspondent Lisa O'Carroll, Katie Balls of The Spectator and the Labour peer Stuart Wood. Now, Boris Johnson would have been hoping to see his Brexit bill pass smoothly through the House of Lords this week, but peers did not make it easy for him. They voted in favour of four amendments, which will most likely be overruled back in the House of Commons later on today, but they gave it a go anyway. And the Northern Ireland Assembly were quick to reject it as well, despite only being back in power for a mere week. Now, Stuart, you tweeted about voting on these amendments. Why did you vote the way you did?
The issues I felt particularly strong on were the issue of child asylum seekers facing Boris Johnson's U-turn on the promise that he would allow them to be reconciled with families that were living in the UK after Brexit. I don't think there's anything constitutive about Brexit that demands that that rule be dropped. I think that just goes against the basic decency of our country. So that for me is straightforward, and it doesn't harm the Brexit project at all. And that was the amendment led by Alf Dubs.
And there are some pretty draconian ones about the courts as well and EU legislation.
I mean, there's extraordinary powers that the government seems to have taken upon itself to essentially instruct lower courts to decide not to apply rules of the EU, that we have to continue from the EU. And I find that very bizarre. And again, a slight hostage to fortune. So the Lords always gets animated by the government taking so-called Henry VIII powers to itself, which allow it essentially to bypass due process. And that tends to excite the interest not of left, right on partisan grounds, but people on sort of due process grounds, and in particular crossbenchers, people who don't have a party affiliation. And that's what happened earlier in the week. So they are reasonable corrections to small details, which either maintain existing commitments or maintain the way that our institutions operate in normal times. And they strike me as entirely reasonable. And that's not a Labour thing to say. I think people across the House felt that.
And these are changes that Boris Johnson has made since the election. So it's different from the withdrawal agreement bill that he presented to Parliament in the autumn. Katie, what does it say about how confident and powerful Boris Johnson's feeling now that he's just decided that he's going to make these changes without really any consultation, stuck them in the bill and said to Parliament, well, you're just going to accept it?
Well, I think this number 10 see Parliament in some ways as an irrelevance. It's not something that they factor hugely in their decisions, and they think because they have a majority of 80, they're not beholden to it. Now, clearly, as we've seen this week with the Lords' defeats, there are still ways that you can show the government that they have to respond, that they have to navigate. But I think it definitely feels to me when I speak to ministers and figures in this government that, in a way, what MPs en masse think, if you take away Lords, is an afterthought. And I think there's also the case that if you were, say, a Labour MP or a Conservative MP who were for some type of Brexit deal but with lots of caveats, I think that you have misplayed your hand, because there was a point before this general election where really the government was trying to think of ways they could bring everyone in because of the parliamentary arithmetic. And there was some plans to give MPs a say or a vote on the negotiating aims. All that stuff has been removed. Now, if you're trying to look for an optimistic explanation of what's been taken out. I think that you would find those on the Tory side say they don't want to have anything held back in these negotiations. They feel that one of the things Theresa May had an issue was that she always had one hand behind her back, and that's why they take things out. But there are clearly some questions over quite a few of those. On the child refugee one, again, the government are saying they're going to come forward and say more about it, but I do sense that's one where some Conservative MPs are not bold enough to say on the record they're uncomfortable with it. Yeah. But I think there are some who think, why not just have it in?
The thing is, we're at the trial of strength stage. The government doesn't want to concede on anything, no matter what the argument. I mean, another amendment this week, which also passed, was the idea that people who've achieved settled status, European Union citizens that achieve settled status in the UK, including my mother, by the way, who's been in since 1964, never got a UK passport. She's now got settled status, but she hasn't got a document because there's no such thing as a certificate telling you you've got it. You just have to trust the computer systems. Now, if you're in a foreign country and you worry about being challenged on this and you don't have any documentation, especially if you're an older person, that is a real worry. Now, the case against this is completely non-existent because people outside the EU who live in the UK have this document. So these documents do exist. It's just that they're not being given to EU settled status people. So, in fact, if you have indefinite leave to remain, I think you have a document. So there is really no case. Why are they opposing it? Because they don't want to give in on anything at the moment. It's a trial of strength. It's showing that the 80 majority Katie talked about matters.
Now, Lisa, how significant are these Brexit bill defeats in the grand scheme of things?
Well, I think it is about continually to try and chisel away the flawed approach that the Tory government had towards EU citizens right from the get-go. So it was Theresa May who decided that she would create this new immigration category for EU citizens when the EU, back in 2017, offered to just to roll over all rights for all EU citizens. So it is absolutely puzzling why, when EU citizens say the very least thing you can do is give us a physical card, which we can show to, really importantly, to employers, to landlords, to banks. And Brandon Lewis, the Home Office Minister, was very, very quick to go on Twitter after the amendment was accepted in the House of Lords to say we will not be changing our position. Digital policy is going to stay. When you talk to EU citizens, I think a lot of people don't understand how it works. It's a bit like that number you get to log into your bank accounts. That's what they're requiring employers and landlords and people to do. Even the Private Landlords Association, the Residential Landlords Association, have come out this morning and say, joining the call for the government to issue fiscal cards and saying there's no reason not to. They point out that some landlords won't even be able to tell what countries are in the EU. So if you say I'm an EU citizen, I'm legitimately here, landlords aren't going to check that. So that is a form of discrimination, and I think it's not the last we've heard of it, even though the amendment is going to be rejected in the House of Commons.
So we don't think the government's going to back down on this. We think that the House of Commons is going to vote to overrule these amendments from the Lords, and that Number 10 don't really seem to care about having peers give them a different opinion on it. Stormont's also rejected the Brexit withdrawal bill on the basis that Brexit in any form won't be good for Northern Ireland. Stuart, do you think there is going to be a level of resentment in Northern Ireland if there is a loss of divergence and checks at the border?
I think there will be. I think the sources of concern in Northern Ireland are actually pretty multiple. I mean, I think that the new story of this new parliament is the future of the union. It's going to be the sort of back burner issue for the next 5 years, almost every day. And actually, I think Scotland is less of a problem for the government than Northern Ireland now. Scotland has sort of got into a standoff, right, with a Catalonia that isn't Catalonia situation. The government's saying no to referendum. I think the SNP kind of knew that they'd say no. They've got their own troubles coming up with the Alex Salmond trial and all that. So I think there'll be a sort of a grumpy stalemate with Scotland. Northern Ireland is a much more precarious situation, a much more dynamic situation. You've got details about the Brexit deal that we still don't know how it's going to work. And there's so much at stake if it doesn't work out properly. You've got cross-community concerns about the Northern Ireland deal. You've got an election in the Republic coming up, where the Sinn Féin have had a little spike in the polls in the last few days. There's real volatility about the next year, let alone public opinion and how it's going to track the sort of uncertainties and ambiguities with the Brexit deal as applies to Northern Ireland. So I think that is really still the Achilles heel for the whole Brexit deal and the future of the union after Brexit.
Lisa, if the House of Lords does back down on these amendments, that means the Brexit bill will pass through Parliament and receive royal assent. It'll be made into law. What's next for the Brexit process after that?
So we'll see 11 o'clock come and go marked in the main in London.
So it's on the 31st of January.
On the 31st at 11 o'clock. So that is when we reach the point of no return. So the Article 50 process is over and it cannot be reversed. So the EU will not, under its rules, will not entertain a rejoin campaign and possibly won't for 10, 20 years. So immediately after that, 1st of February, we move into the second phase of Brexit, which is provided for in the withdrawal agreement that is ratified in Parliament through the Brexit Bill, which gives it effect in British courts, and the European Parliament, which is expected to ratify it on the 29th. So all that being done, 1st of February, we can get this joint committee set up, which has representatives of the EU and the UK. The EU will agree and probably pass, whether the European Commission will pass the negotiating mandate for this phase on the 1st of February. That'll be draft and it'll be published. And then on the 25th, the General Affairs Council meets, which are ministers from each member state, and they will meet, and the expectation is they will ratify that. So we won't see what the EU's negotiating goals are officially until the 25th, so we won't get negotiations up and running until March. So there's an expectation that there will be a window of between March and October to get the deal done.
So one of the things you're talking about, Lisa, is this joint committee. We don't really know very much about it. This is the committee that's going to make very crucial decisions about the future of Northern Ireland. It'll be made up of we don't know, do
we? It's EU and UK representatives, but we don't know who they are. We don't know how many are going to be on the committee. We don't know what the appointment process is. We're expecting that they're going to be ministers from the UK. There was an amendment, wasn't there, in the Brexit Bill? Or the Brexit Bill changed the withdrawal agreement section, which said there could be written representations made to the joint committee. But I think Boris Johnson has said that it has to be a physical minister that will make changes. But yeah, it's going to be a very, very powerful committee.
Katie, have you heard any rumblings about how this could be made up?
I think, as with many things, the number 10 the government suggests they're doing, it's still being worked out. And I think it's clearly going to be fairly sensitive in terms of who's picked and who is seen to have the interest there.
Michael Gove?
Well, Michael Gove, I think, is almost, if we're talking Henry VIII Paris, in terms of, I suppose, who's up in cabinet, I think Michael Gove is someone number 10 trust very much with detail. They trust him across departments. He's being talked up as the CEO. Some think that the CEO should in a way be the Chancellor, who is called Sajid Javid. But I think that Michael Gove is heading for a promotion in this reshuffle we're expecting next week. I also think it's worth pointing out that Julian Smith, the Northern Ireland Secretary, is ultimately someone who had been seen to be destined for the chop. It did not go down particularly well with Boris Johnson and his team that before the general election, Smith was always someone to raise issues or concerns on cabinet calls. But the fact that Stormont is up and running, I think, means that he should be safe, and his stock has considerably rose in terms of the number 10 view.
Stuart, how is this joint committee going to be held to account?
Well, that is the question that people, not just in the Lords, but in the Commons as well, are worried about. The government has said, don't worry, there'll be a minister in this joint committee and you can hold the minister to account. But there's no clarity about who the minister's going to be, whether it's revolving cast list, depending on the issue, the mechanism, which committee is going to be responsible for this. None of that's all detailed to be worked out later. But I think in the 31st of January, we're going to have not just the flags and the sort of tears and the cheers and all that, but we'll also have quite a lot of institutional change. I mean, that's the moment in which the Department of Exiting the EU will cease to exist. The word Brexit will be banned from government speak and from government titles. And I suspect Michael Gove will become the new sort of, not quite like Putin with this new Security Council in Russia, but he'll be the new chair of a big board with a big scope that will essentially run, have tentacles everywhere in Whitehall. That's my sense of what's going to happen.
And we'll see very little of David Frost, apparently. David Frost, who was the chief negotiator who took over from Ollie Robbins, doesn't do media. He will run the Brexit negotiations from a small team in the Cabinet Office, which I'm told could be 30.
Yeah, and called the Europe unit, so we don't mention Brexit.
I think the government's really keen to make Brexit a sort of page 10 of the FT or page 10 of the Guardian story from now on, right?
It's but not going to work.
Fat chance of that, particularly if Michael Gove, by the way, is the chief executive of it. The man wants stories day after day. So I think it's not going to be a trade story. It'll be a political story for a while yet, definitely.
And just moving back to the House of Lords for a minute, Stuart, these amendments that you were proud to vote for in favour of are likely to be overturned when the bill goes back to the House of Commons. And many are expecting now that if it goes back to the House of Lords, peers will just vote in line with the government. Is that what you're expecting? And does that mean that the whole process has been a waste of time?
No, I don't think it's a waste of time because it raises awareness of the issues. Because I think, as Katie said, there are backbench Conservatives who are quietly sympathetic to at least some of these issues. There's all sorts of ways the government can see without looking like it's backed down too much. A couple of these issues, by the way, also may give rise to court cases as well, particularly on EU citizens' rights. So I don't think it's a waste of time at all. But you're right to say that there is a change in the atmosphere around the Lords, in Parliament in general, but also in the Lords, that there's a sense that why press everything until the inevitable defeat? This is not going to do anyone any good. And once you've made your point and the Commons has come back and said no again, I think there's less support for the idea of going to the wall for yet another round of ping pong, as it's called inside Parliament.
So it looks like the House of Lords is going to be probably less powerful over the next 5 years. Do you think, Katie, that the PM is going to take this opportunity to try and clip its wings in any way? We heard this idea floated at the weekend that the House of Lords could be moved up to York or another northern city. It seemed to be some sort of move to separate it from the House of Commons.
Yeah, and I think that's something they're clearly talking about. I do think what's interesting with this government is we've had a lot of bold ideas and they can be diluted, or you talk about them and actually it's much harder to do in practice. But I think there is, you know, little love lost towards the House of Lords. And again, there's just this sense, I think, from some of those around Boris Johnson that they feel the election result has shown that a lot of people, particularly in the Westminster bubble, as perhaps Boris Johnson's senior aide might like to call it, are out of touch with the country. And I think they would put a bulk of the Lords in with that. So when they're saying, oh, we might move this to York, that's what they're getting at. On the issues that we discussed today, I don't expect there to be too much of a game of ping pong, but some of the things in that manifesto, which were on, you know, constitutional reform, the Supreme Courts, I suspect that the Lords are going to be less keen to just drop that once they object once or twice if it is changing how constitutional issues work. And I think at that point, when does it stop? Because the precedent is clear, you know, if the House of Commons then put them back in, then the Lords will step away. But I do think on constitutional issues, we could be heading to more of an ongoing clash between both houses.
How do you think, Stuart, the constitutional battle will shape up? And what do you think about a move to York?
I mean, on the move to York, I feel this is more of a kind of stick-waving move than a practical move. I mean, the idea of putting two houses in totally different cities, I mean, it would make the state opening of Parliament quite interesting when Blackrod knocks on the door and then gets on a train up to York and MPs go up with the Queen on the train, presumably, and listen to the Queen's speech. But it's difficult. Imagine if you're lobbying Parliament, you have to go to London and York to make your case. It's very weird. It's a very weird idea to think about splitting, let alone whether it's in York or London. But I think Katie puts her finger on something that's going to become a really big issue. In the last 10 years or so, the Salisbury Convention, this convention that if something's in a manifesto of a party that wins power, then the Lords has to accept it, whether they like it or not. That's sort of got into abeyance. And it's gone into abeyance because we've had coalition governments and then we've had minority governments. And so the force of that rule, which has been a really important part of British politics for a long time, has really diminished. It's back now. But the interesting thing is it's back with a manifesto that has things in it that the Lords will hate because they see themselves as the, rightly or wrongly, as the arbiters of due process in the way our constitutional system works. So in a manifesto, there are lots of things, as Katie said, that suggest pretty fundamental reform of things like the Supreme Court, maybe even the BBC, other things as well. And the Lords will say, yes, that's in your manifesto. Yes, you've got a majority, but this is really going beyond what a government should be doing. That's going to be a very interesting fight. And if the government wants to have a fight on that, and that's a big if, I think, because at the moment, I think they just like the idea of threatening a fight on it. If they want to have a fight on it, I think there could be a really interesting constitutional moment.
We'll leave it there for now. After the break, Gina Miller tells Kate Proctor why she doesn't see herself entering politics anytime soon, and we talk about the latest casualty of the Labour leadership race. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Rowena Mason. Now, when the news broke that the British public had voted to leave the EU in June 2016, many were utterly shocked, including activist Gina Miller. However, she never expected that she would spend much of the next 3 years dealing with the fallout from her decision to bring cases against the government to the Supreme Court. In 2018, she published her memoir Rise, detailing the story of how she won her case against Theresa May's government, preventing it from invoking Article 50 without the approval of Parliament. But at the end of last year, she republished her memoir with an added epilogue to include a note saying she never envisaged bringing a second government, this time Boris Johnson's, back to the Supreme Court over his decision to prorogue Parliament at the end of last summer. Since bringing that first case, Gina has suffered a torrent of abuse. But as she tells my colleague Kate Proctor, she expects that the divisiveness around the country will only get worse after Brexit.
when I started 3 years ago and I brought the first case, people were angry and upset, and it was a very febrile environment. So they were angry because they thought that I was trying to stop Brexit. Nothing I've done has actually altered the timetable, but the anger was there. But as time has gone on, it has turned to race much more than when we started 3 years ago. And now it is no longer tinged. It is directly about my race. It's the fact that, pictures are made of me where certain media have darkened the colour of my skin when they've reported on me. It's always, foreign-born Gina Miller, or this idea that I can't be bright enough. So Gina Miller is a puppet for white men who just see her as an easy-to-use black woman. It's now very much more overt. And I think part of that is actually about the wider narrative that we're seeing now, because if it was previously unacceptable to have this tone of voice and to be so blatantly racist, people wouldn't be doing it. But it's not being called out by those in positions of power or by certain media. I think it's being stoked. And again, there is really nothing new about this. We've seen it in history in the past. When you want to create a divided society, when you want to damage, if you like, democracy, you other, you create divisions, you create tribes, and you paint people as not being like you. And therefore, it's easier to hurt them, be it physically or with words or with abuse. And that is what I see happening, is a systematic breaking down of our cohesive society, meaning that it's therefore easier to achieve the ultimate goal, which is possibly to change our society.
Do you think there's any chance at all that this government will try and change the tone?
I very much hoped that when the election result came out, because of the magnitude of the win, we would move on. And, Prime Minister Johnson has said that it was going to be one nation. I can only explain to you my experience since the 13th of December. The abuse has gone to a whole different level. I am being targeted on a level at social media which I have never experienced before. Even emails, gifts to my office, which are not pleasant. I even got sent a letter saying that they've discovered that my husband is Jewish and I'm ethnic minority, so therefore my children are mongrels and should have been put down at birth. What I was hoping for doesn't seem to be happening. Maybe it will in time, but I think that has to be set by the politicians and the commentariat and the media, because unless they close this down, I fear that they don't really understand what they're setting our society up for. Months and years of this sort of language and this sort of division will lead into violence, and I fear that there will be a huge price to pay if they do not step up and speak out about what's happening.
What was sent to your office?
It was a box filled with items that just had the British flag on. So it was sweets, books, anything that had the British flag on, how to be British. And it said on the note, "You are not one of us. Go back home." I mean, I even get told, "Go back to Ghana." And I have to think, well, it's the wrong continent. But anyway, but it's languages and it's being repeated. And this idea of going back is very, very dangerous.
And what do you think more generally about the UK, the country, about whether people have come to a point where they accept that Britain is leaving the European Union? Obviously, we know the country is very split, and Boris Johnson got a huge majority in which he told people we will be leaving. So clearly, electorally, there's an acceptance that that is the direction of travel. But do you think the country more widely has started to feel, yes, we accept that this is what's happening now? Or people that voted Remain, do you think that they might be slowly coming round to what might be this new future?
I think it's more like a mourning, being in mourning. There are those who move on quicker than others. And this idea that we can somehow rejoin straight away is fantasy. There's a bit of fantasy happening on both sides, I feel. From people in the middle, there is a great sorrow and a hole in Britain right now. I come across people, irrespective of how they voted and which party they belong to, feeling that we are not the same country, that we are lacking competency and leadership, that there is a mistrust in politics. There is a mistrust about the intentions of the US and the rest of the world in relation to us. Where is our place in the world? There are many, many unanswered questions. And I feel a real sense of loss, both in leaving the EU, but in who are we and how do we go forwards and what happens next. And all of that would, I feel, be somehow moving towards a place of hope if we had good leadership. And that is what I think is a real tragedy at the moment, irrespective of where it comes from, is we need strong leadership that can bring the country together, both in our government, but also in our opposition. And I don't see that yet.
Do you ever see a point at which you would become involved in politics yourself?
I think the things I would want to see changing in politics are not going to happen in Britain at this moment or for the medium term. And so I wouldn't enter a political arena where I see that literally everything has to change. People sometimes say to me, quite oddly, that there's quite a lot of commonality between myself and Mr. Cummings in that we believe in a meritocracy. I believe in a different sorts of institutions, a much fairer system, a much fairer political system as well as electoral system. But I'm sure that turkeys are not going to vote for Christmas anytime soon. So I would stay out of politics, but still stay very much with an eye looking at what happens to our constitution, what happens to our democracy, what happens to rights, what happens to social justice. So I'll carry on doing the things I've been doing for 30 years.
So you can affect change, though, from an elected position. So you wouldn't want to be part of that restructuring or trying to drive it from being elected yourself.
I think it needs to change at the moment. We need to deal with one problem at the moment almost. Right now, Brexit does need to put to bed. And whatever this government achieves or doesn't then needs to be reviewed. And at that point, it may well be that if they aren't able to deliver what they've promised to our country, then things will have to change and change dramatically.
You said that friends and family have said to you, you know, Gina, when is enough enough? When are you going to just have a bit of a relax and stop? Can you see that happening anytime soon? Or do you think, if you see a case where you think legal action, legal intervention is necessary, you'll just seize it and you'll do it again?
No, because the ground has changed. This government have made it very clear, both in their manifesto and in the withdrawal agreement, and to some degree, the political declaration, although that is not set in stone, that they are going to fundamentally look at changing the relationship between the courts, the law, parliament, the government. So there is a restructuring going on, and it's a very dangerous one in my view, because the rule of law is integral to our stability as a modern democracy. So I don't think there will be that many opportunities for legal action, but there are always opportunities for civil responsibility and voicing concerns and campaigning. And so I will carry on doing that if it looks as though people's lives are going to be diminished.
Now, Jess Phillips, the outspoken backbench Labour MP and women's rights campaigner, was seen by many as the wildcard candidate who really enthused the Corbyn sceptic wing of the Labour Party. But after a pretty weak Hustings performance in Liverpool on Saturday, many were rethinking their predictions, including Phillips herself. After missing Tuesday's GMB Hustings, the MP announced she was dropping out of the race. And so now we have four. Stuart, were you disappointed at all to see Phillips drop out yesterday and Clive Lewis not make the ballot paper earlier on?
Yeah, I was disappointed both of those because they both represent parts of the party with good friends of mine in those parts of the party that I think now feel that the candidates don't have a spread that they would like. So yeah, I think it would have been better to have had a bigger number of people going through to the ballot stage and to get on the ballot and to go to the hustings.
And Katie just said that she felt that she couldn't unite all parts of our movement, the union movement, members and elected representatives. What do you think was her biggest barrier? Do you think she just realised she wasn't going to win, effectively?
Yeah, I mean, I think the fact, correct me if I go wrong here, she didn't have a single CLP nomination and no union had moved to back her, suggested that she just wasn't in a place to do that. And I remember speaking to people involved with the Jess Phillips campaign at the start of the Labour leadership contest, and I was saying, well, Jess Phillips doesn't seem particularly popular with Corbynites. And they said, no, Jess Phillips can win the Labour leadership contest. She just needs to get 130,000 new members to join Labour. Small ask. Now, you have heard around, I think, 100,000 join, but it was just clear to me from that in order for Jess Phillips to win, even those around her thought that the party had to change rather than that she had to rule the party, which was a different way about going about it. I think that it's not clear that had she got to the third stage that it would have worked anyway. But even if you want to change the party, you've still got to convince those people who are already there to get through the second stage. And I don't think she worked enough on that. And also at times it felt as though she hadn't really thought through her campaign that much. So she herself, in the piece she wrote for The Guardian after those hustings, saying, you know, she hadn't been herself. But I think Jess Phillips has always been someone who has actually had more cut through than lots of Labour politicians with the general public in terms of who they would recognise. She struck a chord with some people, but it's not enough just to be personable. I think you have to be able to explain what direction you're taking it in.
Lisa, what do you think about what the candidates are saying about Brexit? We know Keir Starmer is somebody that pushed very strongly for a pro-referendum position, and Rebecca Long-Bailey was more on the other side of the argument. She was more hesitant about that.
Well, it's almost as if, in the same way that the Tory party want to get rid of the word Brexit, that Brexit is something, a bit of a toxic subject for the Labour Party, given the result of the election. I'm not in Westminster in the lobby, so I'm not following it day by day. Just from a viewer's point of view, I thought Jess Phillips, yes, she's got plenty of cut through with voters, but I wonder if she made a kind of fatal misstep in that first interview with Andrew Marr when she was asked about what her position would be on Brexit. And she talked about the, you know, being a rejoin candidate, and then the following day she had to row back a little on that. The other candidates, yes, Keir Starmer is associated with the second referendum and the Remain side, isn't he?
Yes, like Emily Thornberry too.
Lisa Nandy, I think the impression would be that she would be more associated with the plight of the North, and I think her stock could rise over the coming weeks. She's a good speaker and she acquitted herself very well on the Today programme this morning, which I know is a very small London elite audience, but nonetheless it gives you a good idea of somebody's mettle in the face of adverse attack.
The thing is, to become Labour leader, you've got to play three different games in order. The first game is with your parliamentary colleagues to get 22 nominations. The second game is with the dense institutional network inside the Labour Party, trade unions, affiliated societies. And then the third is with the membership, where it's one member, one vote. And those are three very different kinds of games.
And then, of course, the electorate after that.
And then the electorate after that, and the commentariat all the way through. And guys, you know, people like you are covering it all the time. All these games have to be played simultaneously. Katie's right. I think Jess had a appeal with a certain constituency that really didn't help her very much with the crucial second phase. That was ultimately her problem.
And some commentators have questioned the fairness of the way the process happens, and it's actually changed from previous contests. Do you think there needs to be a review of all these hurdles that the candidates have to get through?
Another review. I think there's an oddness about this second round. So the first round is getting through the first stages to get your MPs or MEP colleagues to get you through a threshold. This second stage is as I say, about getting trade unions and affiliated societies or constituency parties to support you. I think the idea of getting constituency parties to back you is a good idea. And trade unions, I think, is an important part of our movement. I think the numbers on it are a bit odd, these two different routes by which you can get either 5% of all constituency parties or three affiliated societies, as long as they're 5% of the total membership. It's really...
The members of the public just do not understand it, I think. No matter how many explainers you do, I think people can't follow the leadership.
It'd be quite good to have a sort of minimum membership petition sort of threshold, which would get you through onto the ballot, for example. That'd be a way of encouraging people to go straight to members to get you onto the ballot. But I'm pretty loath to have yet another review of these internal rules. I mean, if ever there was a navel-gazing exercise, it's Labour spending 6 months changing its internal rules about these things.
Stuart, you advised Ed Miliband when he was in opposition. What would you advise the next Labour leader to do to crucially break through to the public up against a Prime Minister who's quite powerful at the moment?
This feels very much like 1987. Obviously, I'm too young to remember 1987, but I'm told it's a very similar majority, very similar election result, a Labour leader who knows that they're not going to get any victories. And that was already after 8 years of opposition then, just like now. But I think the key thing is to be humble, to be known as someone who is almost the antidote to Boris Johnson. Don't try and play Boris Johnson his own game by being this sort of excessively charismatic person with all these one-liners here, there. And that's not the way that you're going to beat Boris Johnson. So depending on who becomes leader, I think spend 1 or 2 years doing a really overt listening exercise, but just starting to build a different philosophy, a different way forward, which turns its back on the past without attacking the past too much. That's really the challenge. But it's going to be a very long game for whoever wins.
Lisa, you were saying that Labour candidates seem to be trying to avoid the subject of Brexit and move on to other issues. How do you think a new leader can appeal to a really divided public and bring them together?
Well, listening to Stuart there just reminded me of a column that Gary Young, who's recently left The Guardian, wrote immediately after the election, and he made the point that, you know, the opposition to the Tories is not going to be from the Labour benches because, as you said, it's unlikely there's going to be any victory in terms of legislation. And he said, you know, remember that the Labour Party is not the left and the left is not the Labour Party. And the big question for people on the left is going to be, how do you hold the Conservatives to account? So I think we're going to see kind of centres of power emerge in other areas, whether it's through academia or, you know, those people who represent those people who are the victims of social injustice, the poor, the food banks. Those voices are going to be equally important and will bubble up in the next year or so, as, you know, the electoral result can't achieve a strong opposition in Westminster.
Well, that's lots for the Labour Party and us to think about over the next few months, but that is all for this week. My thanks to all of our guests, Larry Elliott, Lisa O'Carroll, Katie Balls, Stuart Wood, Gina Miller and Kate Proctor. The producer was Danielle Stevens. I'm Rowena Mason. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.